This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Well, clearly you needed a headlamp or a flashlight because almost all the windows had been boarded over and there was no heat or power in the building. As you navigated through, there was a lot of water damage and there was water or ice on the floors inside the building.
Welcome to the second episode of the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited series sponsored by Quinn Evans. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and preservationist who specializes in sustainable design. Many of you know me as the host of the Tangible Remnants podcast, where I demystify the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Beyond the podcast, I'm also an associate principal at Quinn Evans, where I help to bring adaptive reuse projects to life. This limited series will highlight one successful adaptive reuse project per episode and will feature people involved in the project from both the design side and the client side. This series is going to pull back the curtain and do a deep dive into each project to discuss how a project went from conception to completion, the lessons learned along the way, and how the building is positively impacting the community today. By the end of each episode, you'll have better insight into some of the unforeseen conditions that come up on an adaptive reuse project and the types of decisions that can impact your project. It's all part of my goal of demystifying the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Today's episode is all about the transformation of the Walter French Academy in Lansing, Michigan. From the owner side, I'm joined by the current executive director of Capital Area Housing Partnership, Emma Henry, as well as the former executive director of Capital Area Housing Partnership, Raleigh Van Fossen, who is now the director of economic development and planning for the city of Lansing. From the Quinn Evans design team, I'm joined by Ann Dilcher, principal and lead architect of the project, as well as Jacqueline Peterson-Melfi, the project architect who's also been instrumental in transforming this once vacant historic building. From navigating financial hurdles to engaging with the community, if you've ever wondered what it takes to breathe new life into a long abandoned building, this episode is for you. Our guests share their experiences and discuss how a shared vision with a dedicated team can transform not just a building, but an entire community. Now, before we jump into the conversation, let me give you some history on the building. So to address the school overcrowding issue that resulted from the rise in population due to the booming automobile business in the 1910s and 1920s, the Lansing School Board acquired a 6-acre lot to build a new school. The building was designed in the 1920s by Michigan architect Judson N. Churchill, and this L-shaped building had space for grades 7 through 9 and a little bit of additional space for grades 1 through 6. The school was named after Professor Walter H. French, a well-regarded educational leader who lived in the Lansing area. In 1950, the school was converted to be solely a junior high, and in 1957, a new wing was added. However, falling enrollment caused the school to be closed in 1981. In 1983, the Eyde Company purchased the school building, and in 1996, it reopened as a charter school, the Walter French Academy of Business and Technology, which included a middle school and high school. About 4 years later, sometime between 1999 and 2000, the school then added a K-12 program to become, quote, the first local public school to offer kindergarten through 12th grade and under one roof. Unfortunately, in 2004, the school lost ties to its authorizer, Central Michigan University, and was ultimately shut down that year due to financial problems. Although the building remained vacant, unfortunately, it caught fire in 2016, and the cause of the fire was unknown. In January 2018, the Eyde family donated the building to the Capital Area Housing Partnership, a nonprofit affordable housing group. Capital Area Housing Partnership has a mission to develop strong and diverse neighborhoods, emphasizing affordable housing, home ownership opportunities, and financial security for residents in mid-Michigan. And as you'll hear, their Walter French project is one of the ways they've been able to fulfill their mission. Capital Area Housing Partnership hired Quinn Evans to lead the renovation efforts. Focusing on providing units for low-income residents, the design team turned classrooms into apartments and created 10 amenities such as a fitness center, a daycare, and leasable office space amenities that are often not easily accessible to these tenants. The project leveraged historic tax credits and a number of other incentives in its funding stack. So be sure to check out the show notes for visuals of the project and other adaptive reuse resources. And while you're in the show notes, go ahead and sign up for the Tangible Remnants newsletter to get adaptive reuse tips right to your inbox. You'll hear more about Quinn Evans later in the episode, but for now, let's jump into the conversation. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation about the Walter French Project, featuring Raleigh Van Fossen, Emma Henry, Jackie Peterson-Melfi, and Ann Dilcher. I am so thrilled to have all of you on the show today to talk about the Walter French Project in Lansing, Michigan. This project has had a huge impact on the community, and I'd love to talk about how you got involved in the project and the beginnings of how you came to know the building and the organization that you're working with. And so, Raleigh, I'll start with you.
Sure, I appreciate it. So where did I begin with Walter French? I have to go back to from the fall of 2017, when I was a board member of Capital Area Housing Partnership, and our then executive director, Mickey Drosty, had brought forward a proposed development, the next big project for the nonprofit to do, and if it met its mission. Fast forward, the board said yes to accepting this old vacant school that had sat vacant for many years prior to into the city of Lansing to see if the nonprofit could take it on and redevelop it to fit its mission need. It's funny because shortly then after we accepted the project as a board, I then transitioned to a staff role at Capital Area Housing Partnership and later became its executive director. And with that team, worked diligently to bring together what we see today. That is now Walter French.
So you got to see the project from multiple angles. And so then, Emma, what about you? What was your introduction to the project?
So similar to Raleigh's story, I was also a board member at Capital Area Housing Partnership in 2017. And after a lot of discussion, we did accept the donation of the building. I also joined staff a few months later and have served on staff for the last 8 years, with the last year and a half serving as the executive director. And so have seen a lot of phases of this journey from different angles as well, but really excited to now be looking at the end result and the finished product of this project.
And I'm so excited that we have both past and current executive director of the organization. That's so exciting. And so, Anne, I know you've been with the project since Quinn Evans got on board with it. So talk a little bit about how that process came about.
Yeah, so we got a call from Gidros as well, and she was at that time helping shepherd the project, helping trying to understand the finances and what are all the tax credit options for getting the project off the ground and moving forward. And she was connected with us as a firm that really works on historic projects and on housing projects. So Quinn Evans with my leadership had done a similar project in Fremont, Michigan, and then one in Eaton Rapids, Michigan as well. And so we're very familiar sort of with this age and type of building. This one is a lot bigger than those other ones that we looked at and perhaps was in worse shape, but we're always excited to go and walk and see the opportunities that a building like this has to get transformed.
Yes. And we'll get into the shape of the building in just a minute. But first, Jackie, why don't you tell us a little bit of when you joined the project? I know you, of the four, you were the one who joined the project the latest.
Yep, I'm kind of helping to get the project wrapped up at the end. I did come in during some of the design phases just to pop in and help out here and there. But really, I didn't come in until midway through construction of phase one, which is the residential portion, and then also wrapping up some of the drawings and currently with construction on phase two, the commercial portion.
Nice. Well, let's get into the building. And so Raleigh mentioned that the building had been vacant for many years. So Anne, when you first walked into the building, what was it like and what did it look like in terms of the condition of the building?
Well, clearly you needed a headlamp or a flashlight because almost all the windows had been boarded over and there was no heat or power in the building. As you navigated through, there was a lot of water damage and there was water or ice on the floors inside the building. So it was a little tricky to navigate. Knowing those types of buildings, we weren't worried that the structure wasn't sound, perhaps looking to understand the condition of the roof, but we knew the building and the structure was sound. So it was, how do we clean it up? There was the gym space, was an interesting space because there had been a fire in the gym and there had been an addition to the original historic gym. And so then again, all the windows there had been covered over and it was a dark space, but it was one where I was excited to wave my arms around and say, oh, with all the light from all the windows that will be in here, this would be such a wonderful space to work in. So seeing those possibilities was exciting.
And so Raleigh, what was it like the first time you walked through the building after you got to see what it looked like? It's like, oh, this is our building now. We're going to do something with it.
Certainly. It was Lansing's best kept secret. One of our, unfortunately, haunted houses that we didn't have opened, charging for folks to come through. Because to Anne's point, it was a dark maze. You know, I vividly remember the first time on staff when we had hired our first security patrol to go in and clear the building, as we would say, make sure there's nobody who shouldn't be in there and vice versa. And I remember walking ahead of the security person, turning back, saying, wait a second, I feel like our roles are opposite. Shouldn't this be the other way around? But that just shows you the massive size and gives you some perspective, at least virtually, as I tell you over the microphone, of these large corridors. I mean, we're talking a building that was opened first in 1925, that really since the late 80s have been shuttered closed and not being used. So when you have something that, you know, utilities are off, to Anne's point, windows are covered, it gets quite eerie in there. I will say it maybe took me a bit longer than perhaps the Quinn Evans team to see what could become, but I was so excited once we did our first pass through the building and really got a lay of the land, started working with Quinn Evans team to see that there's much more here that we don't see. We just have to give it time.
Yeah. And then what about you? What were your experiences from walking through the building?
I think eerie is a really great word. Scary might be another word, I would say. You never knew if you were opening a door to a room full of pigeons that would fly at you, or a floor that was wavy like the ocean, but was made of wood. Definitely not the safest journey, and truly amazing as we walk through now on our construction draws to see the transformation. We had some before and after photos taken of the same viewpoints, and it's almost hard to believe that you're standing in the same spot when you look at those photos.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful for you all to share those stories, because I think sometimes people think that once a building is in such a bad state, it can't be brought back. And we'll put a link to some of those before and after photos in the show notes, just so people can see
how different space can look with a little bit of vision and a lot of leadership and management and also tenacity. And so I know that this was a journey, both from the design side, but then also from the financial and community building side. And so Raleigh, talk a little bit about how the deal came together and some of the work that went into that.
Certainly. You know, accepting a free school isn't for the faint of heart. And so I was appreciative that, you know, myself and Emma as board members, but then transitioned into staff, first had the full support of the nonprofit board. You know, it's a mission-based organization celebrating well over 30 years of work in the mid-Michigan community. This isn't the first school that they had participated in a full gut rehab, but it certainly was the largest and had the most intricacies both on the finance side and the construction side. And so to your point, how does a deal like that begin to take shape? It starts with that vision. I give much credit to my predecessor and also the board as a whole at that time who saw a need in the mid-Michigan region for more affordable housing. And not just any old affordable housing, but affordable housing that brought value to those who ultimately get to call it home. The neat thing about Walter French is it not only offered us that vision of providing affordable housing, but enabled the team to do so much more, including the nonprofit office space and the childcare center that's opening there as well. So when we took that vision, then becomes the fun part. How do you pay for it? And how do you structure a deal and a capital stack like this together? You know, a building of that magnitude that's on the National Registry is going to have its complications in terms of not only governing what we can do, but how we can do it, and ultimately what's the price tag to get there. And certainly the Quinn Evans team was instrumental in helping us navigate that process. But in Michigan, one of the mainstream funding sources that we first started out with and one of our immediate partners was those who also value and better yet fund affordable housing. And so that's first our partners at the City of Lansing, but having the buy-in both of the mayor of the time and still our current mayor, but the Community Development Office who has certain entitlement dollars that are dedicated to affordable housing, ensuring that's a piece of the puzzle. And then going to our partners at the state, the Michigan State Housing Development Authority is really the key here that made much of this financing package together. And that's through the incredible work of the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program. That program has been around for decades. It's funded nationwide and is probably one of the most instrumental tools available to developers across the country still today to complete and make affordable housing projects successful. Unfortunately, even just with those two partners coming on board early on, it still wasn't enough. You know, I don't know the final number that Emma and team have landed on, but I know when I left, we were upwards $35 million total development costs for a project. And that's expensive in the Lansing region, especially for a building in its condition and to see the immense work that went through. So it included and required us to add more to that capital stack, right? And so we had the City of Lansing come in. We had the state with low-income housing tax credits. That brought a national syndicator. The Walker Dunlap team came in. But then we had some great support from our community partners. We had a community bank. Dart Bank is a local community bank here in mid-Michigan. Was instrumental, not only bringing us access to capital, but access to the Federal Home Loan Bank of Indianapolis, grant dollars that came from there. I know we've worked hard, Emma and team, to get community foundation support. We received support through the county we're within, which is Ingham County. They brought dollars together from the American Rescue Plan. All said and done, there are over 12, if not more, financing layers in this capital stack. And I can't speak for every developer, but certainly in my role at CAP and now my current role at the city, I'm seeing a lot of other housing projects come into play with 5, maybe 6 different layers to their capital stack. And so it's daunting, but exciting to see that the Capital Area Housing Partnership team was able to successfully put together, again, just over 12 different layers to that capital stack.
And I think the capital stack and understanding it makes such a difference, particularly when you're working with an architect who understands that there are different layers to the capital stack and that different design decisions are going to impact what's allowed in that capital stack. And so, Anne, as you were working through the design and also making sure that Quinn Evans was complying with what was needed, what were some of the design iterations that you had to keep in mind?
You know, I think it was a play between what's required from Michigan, from MISHDA for the housing, and then back to what's required on the historic and what spaces have we identified as most important and how we are going to deal with and treat those. Like I said, we had done a few of these before, and so we had a good sense of where we could push and pull on some of those. I think one of them that came up interestingly enough was flooring. There's one that says they would like carpet and the other one says it was a school and so it should be wood or look like wood. So negotiating back and forth between the two for this project so it could go forward with the funding that it had. I think another piece on this one that was very interesting and also complicated in terms of understanding the building itself from a code perspective and from a use perspective and a historic perspective was the fact that this building couldn't just function as housing. It was too big and there were other spaces. And so that's where, as Raleigh mentioned, the side where there's the nonprofit, there's the childcare that's going in, and that other use, the commercial side of it plus the housing side of it. And so each of those have their own requirements for access, for elevator. It is a three-story building, for egress, for stairs to safely get out, and to separate these buildings really with firewalls between them. But at the same time, on the historic side, this was a school and these were open hallways. And so how do we make that division between the spaces, but also respect the historic, where when you got to the central crossroads, you could look down the whole hallway in one direction or the other. And now we're dividing the spaces.
Mm-hmm. I know there was a really interesting story around the pool that exists there and what that turned into. So can you talk a little bit about that design change?
Sure. The historic pool was buried in and under the building. It had been reused at one time, I think, when there were gymnastics or something. So it was full of all these foam blocks. And then there had been a fire in that space. And it was a difficult fire because you can imagine all the chemicals that are released if it's the burning and foam. So it was very much a dark, burned out space. But going back again to the historic drawings, before there was an addition that we took off, it had a whole series of windows along it. It's on the first floor with nice access out to the back, to the parking, to space for playground. And so it was a great spot to reuse that as a childcare facility to serve people in the community, people in the building. It just was a really nice fit and great combination.
Let's take a quick break so you can learn more about the sponsor of this limited series, Quinn Evans. Quinn Evans is a design firm committed to stewardship and the transformation of places that serve and inspire communities. As the proud recipient of the American Institute of Architects 2024 Architecture Firm Award, Quinn Evans is driven by the belief in the power of design to sustain, renew, and reimagine the built environment. Through partnerships with public institutions, nonprofits, and private organizations, Quinn Evans delivers thoughtful design that connects people and leaves a lasting impact. Discover more at quinnevans.com. That's www.quinnevans.com. And now, back to the show.
And so in addition to funding it and then designing it, we also have to make sure that the construction is actually handled in a way that adheres to what was designed. And so Jackie, as you were on board to do a lot of the construction administration and working with the contractors, were there any surprises or kind of what was your experience in helping the contractor fulfill design of the documents?
There are always surprises, but I don't know that there's really been anything that's been a huge roadblock other than some dings and things that need to be polished along the way. This is an adaptive reuse, so we're making what's there as great as we can. And it is turning out to be a really beautiful project.
Yeah. Since it's opened, Emily, you had mentioned one of our pre-calls, there have been a number of tours. So talk to us a little bit about how the community has been receiving the building.
As you can imagine, this building has been standing on a prominent corner in Lansing for 100 years. So a lot of individuals have not only driven by on these main corridors, but spent time in the building. Maybe they attended school there. I've met with individuals who taught at that school, who took gymnastics classes, as Anne mentioned, who played against Magic Johnson in the basketball court in the back gym. And so there's a lot of emotional connections to the building, as well as individuals that have just seen it as an important part of Lansing's history that they want to remember. So we've had conversations with probably every organization in town, from the school district, to the public library, who had a lot of the historic photos that we were able to reference for the historic reuse, as well as neighbors who have just wanted to come inside and say thank you for restoring a building that really wasn't a benefit to the neighborhood for the past 20 or so years. And it's been really heartwarming to hear those stories from individuals directly, to see the donations from all the organizations along the street on that corridor, whether it's the convenience store across the street who wanted to give every new resident a free coupon for some snacks at the store, to the art gallery a couple corners away in Rio Town that wanted to offer a free class to every single resident, or the YMCA who offered 6-month passes to every single person that moved in. A lot of these partnerships we didn't ask for or reach out for, they came to us and said, thank you for investing in this building, in this community, and improving our daily life and our experience in Lansing.
That's fantastic. And I love to hear how the community is really wrapping its arms around the building and the residents and really trying to celebrate all of the work that's been done there. And so then I'm curious for each of you, what are some lessons learned that you take with you from this project? I'm sure there were many, from the financial to the design to unforeseen conditions. So what are any lessons learned or even tips of advice that you would like to share with anyone who might also have their own vacant, abandoned building that they need to reuse? Riley, we'll start with you.
Sure. I like that last part. For anybody who has a vacant building that they're trying to repurpose, game on. A lesson, or at least one that stuck out to me, is this, like many projects, went through the COVID pandemic. And that was quite significant on our project for a variety of reasons. You know, for me, the lesson learned in all of this was to not feel that you have to bear any of this alone. And so if you're a developer out there with that vacant building you mentioned, trying to think of what to do, it may sound cliche to say, but it really starts with surrounding yourself with well-rounded development team, you know, to come in and not feel as if you have to be the smartest person in the room, let alone the person with all the answers. That's what, at least as we talked with the folks on today, made me incredibly excited to be able to work with the Quinn Evans team. Because when we first got this and knew that following the historic integrity of the building, trying to meet the standards of the National Park Service was incredibly important, not only to our board, but to the surrounding community, to the mayor, working with our partners and friends at the state who ultimately directed us to Quinn Evans was key, because that helped us get through that. So what I mean by the pandemic is we were ready, we were getting close to the finish line, and then a global pandemic happens and almost, if not stops all construction in the state of Michigan, if not many places across the country and world. But for us in little old Lansing, what that meant was, you know, all those funding commitments, those are hard dates. Just like if you're put on a small scale buying a house, you know, your mortgage lender is going to have a rate lock and that's going to expire. And so to think of those 12 capital sources we had pre-pandemic, we were around 8 or 9. The pandemic caused us, like many, to have to go back to the drawing board, find more money because costs have since increased. But it also encouraged us or required us to go back to the Quinn Evans team to say, pre-pandemic, we didn't have to value engineer as much as we thought. Now we do. Gave me comfort, and the lesson learned was truly this ability, and it almost with luck, we were able to surround ourselves with the key development partners who made that easy. You know, that was a tough conversation to value engineer things out of a project, especially for a group like the Housing Partnership. With this being the largest project to date, we wanted it all. We wanted the community to get all of what they wanted out of this project as well. And I really think Anne and her team took that to heart with what they were able to bring us. And so it hurt me that in the pandemic, we had to go back and draw back even more, because those are tough conversations. But again, the lesson learned in that, and what ultimately made it easy maybe, is the fact that we surrounded ourselves at the Housing Partnership with the right development team, really made that part not as painstaking as I may have thought it once was going into it.
Fantastic. Emma, what about you?
I would definitely echo those comments. And the word of advice is keep your mind open, remain flexible. You never know what will happen. Development isn't a short-term project. We accepted this donation in 2017, and we're halfway through 2025 looking at the finish line. And so you could face barriers that you can't even imagine. But if you have a good team around you, as Raleigh mentioned, you can face those, you can get through those. And I think it really requires bringing the community around and including them in the planning process. We did a lot of conversations with people around the city, but specifically in the neighborhoods that surrounded this project, and said, what would you love to see? Now we might have had some ice cream store comments or a coffee shop that we weren't able to incorporate into this specific project. But we also got a lot of great feedback. And so when we went back to those neighborhoods and said, hey, we're having some challenges, this is what we're going to do, what do you think about this? They were more receptive to understanding that we were serious. We were going to get this project done no matter what. And they knew we would find a way. And that, I believe, really helped us when we went to the elected officials and said, we're having trouble with the funding gap. How can we be creative and fill this so we can make this project across the finish line, give the community what they've asked for, and make it a great project for everyone involved? That luckily, I guess, or cross our fingers, we got a lot of support from elected officials from our city, state, county, federal level to make sure that this project happened. And I don't know if that would have been true if we had a lot of community opposition. A lot of people have found a challenge with communities and neighborhoods surrounding affordable housing projects, but for various reasons, this one has been beloved by the community and the negative comments have been few and far between. There has been much more positive, overflowing, happy comments from individuals all across our region.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. And over to you.
I didn't similarly have on my list of lessons learned the communication and compromises, right? Any building like this is going to have surprises as you go through. They may not be as big as a global pandemic, but as you go through, it's really keeping that discussion going and understanding what are the goals, who are we serving, and so that we can make decisions based on those big picture goals that we've set out at the start. Is this a compromise that we can live with and move forward with or not? And also keeping those communications, as I said, we were constantly talking to State Historic Preservation Office and to MSHDA to understand here's how regulations or perspectives might differ. What's the compromise we can come to that supports the big idea, the goal that you guys are trying to achieve, even if it may mean there's a change to the letter of what you're asking for? I would also say if you do have a big building, abandoned building sitting out there to make our jobs easier, try and find the funding so that you can clean out the building first. There was a lot of debris in this building, and it just made it a lot more challenging on the architectural side to document and understand and have as good a documentation we would like. Once the project could start and there was funding there, then the building could get cleared out and opened up and we could go back and revise things because some places the conditions were different. And understanding eras of building is also very important. This, while yes, it's a building from 1925, there is also a very large addition on it from the 80s, I believe. And so understanding there, we were really working through two different eras of construction, which calls for different detailing on the architectural side. And then as they talk about the capital funding stack, a lesson learned to me is to make sure I get my accounting straight early and knowing all the pieces, because our fee as well was getting paid from different buckets and we needed to make sure that we could separate that out to support the funding.
Makes sense. And Jackie, over to you.
I think with projects like these, and maybe especially this one, just building on what everybody else has already said, like being at front of mind what the intentions are, not only like our intentions in design or, the intention for the final building use, but also with all these levels of review that have to happen. Even when rules are conflicting, there's a reason that the rule is there in place. And so if you just try to balance what everybody's trying to get at, for example, carpet in an apartment is going to help with sound transfer from apartment to apartment. And so if there's a way you can kind of address that while also kind of meeting other requirements, say from the State Historic Preservation Office, you're not always going to get it right. But if we can kind of get to the best solution, and then being honest and open with everybody that's looking at it, everyone's on that same team and we'll get there.
Next week, on the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited series, sponsored by Quinn Evans. We'll hop over to Detroit to learn more about the Love Building. Tune in to learn how a nonprofit turned displacement into a place for the community and a hub of other nonprofits.
And so we, at that time, had to make the really painful decision to ask the existing tenants that were left to move out. And it was painful because we had ourselves experienced displacement from the neighborhood where we had just been living. And we saw this as a pattern that was happening all over the city. And so at that point, in an attempt to sort of remediate and not just fuel these cycles of displacement, we committed to having the building be developed with a community benefits agreement at its heart that would ensure that it was a resource not only for the organizations who needed this new home, but for the surrounding neighborhood and community and the city as a whole.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving. But compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.